Chapter 14. The twin-engined Buccaneer jet transport touched down smoothly and taxied to a quiet corner of Andrews Air Force Base, southeast of Washington. Fitted out comfortably for high-ranking Air Force officers, the aircraft flew nearly as fast as the most modern fighter plane. As the flight steward, in the uniform of an Air Force Master Sergeant, carried their luggage to a waiting car and driver, Pitt marveled at Admiral Sandecker's influence in the capital city. He wondered what general the Admiral had conned into temporarily lending the plane to Numa, and what manner of persuasion it took. Giordino dozed during the drive, while Pitt stared unseeing at the low buildings of the city. The rush-hour traffic had begun streaming out of town, and the streets and bridges leading into the suburbs were jammed. Fortunately, their car was traveling in the opposite direction. Pitt cursed his idiocy for not returning to Ice Hunter shortly after liftoff. If Giordino had interpreted her message correctly, Maeve was in some sort of trouble. The possibility that he had deserted her when she was calling out to him gnawed at his conscience. The long arm of Sandecker reached through his melancholy and cast a shroud over his preoccupation with guilt. Never in Pitt's years with Numa had he ever placed his personal problems above the vital work of the agency. During the flight to Punta Arenas, Giordino had provided the crowning touch. "There's a time for being horny, and this isn't it. People and sea life are dying by the boatload out there on the water. The sooner we stop this evil, the more lives will be spared to pay taxes. Forget her for now. When this cauldron of crap is over, you can take a year off and chase her down under." Giordino might never have been hired to teach rhetoric at Oxford, but he seldom failed to fill a book with common sense. Pitt surrendered and reluctantly eased Maeve from his mind, not entirely successfully. The memory of her lingered like a portrait that became more beautiful with the passage of time. His thoughts were broken as the car rolled over the driveway in front of the tall, green, solar-glassed building that housed Numa's headquarters. The visitor's parking lot was covered with television transmitter trucks and vans, emitting enough microwaves to launch a new chicken rotisserie franchise. "I'll run you into the underground parking area," said the driver. "The vultures were expecting your arrival." "You sure an axe-murderer isn't roaming the building?" asked Giordino. "No, the reception is for you. The news media are starved for details of the cruise ship massacre. The Australians tried to put a tight lid on it, but all hell broke loose after the surviving passengers talked when they reached Chile. They were glowing in their praise of how you guys rescued them and saved the cruise ship from going on the rocks. The fact that two of them were daughters of Diamond King Arthur Dorset naturally excited the exposé rags." "So now they're calling it a massacre," Pitt sighed. "Lucky for the Indians they can't blame this one on them," said Giordino. The car stopped in front of a security guard stationed in front of a small alcove that led to a private elevator. They signed an entry form and took the elevator to the 10th floor. When the doors opened, they stepped into a vast room that was Hiram Yeager's electronics fiefdom, from which the computer wizard directed Numa's vast data systems network. Yeager looked up from a huge horseshoe-shaped desk in the middle of the room and smiled broadly. No bib overalls today, but he was wearing a faded Levi's jacket that looked like it had been dragged from Tombstone to Durango by a horse. He jumped to his feet and came from behind the desk, vigorously shaking Pitt's and Giordino's hands. "Good to see you two scoundrels back in the building. It's been as dull as an abandoned amusement park since you skipped to the Antarctic." "Always good to be back on a floor that doesn't rock and roll," said Pitt. Yeager grinned at Giordino. "You look nastier than when you left." "That's because my feet still feel cold as ice," Giordino replied in his usual burlesque tone. Pitt glanced about the room crowded with electronic data systems and a crew of technicians. "Are the Admiral and Rudy Gunn on hand?" "Waiting for you in the private conference room," answered Yeager. "We assumed you and Al would go there first." "I wanted to catch you before we all sat down." "What's on your mind?" "I'd like to study your data on sea serpents." Yeager raised his eyebrows. "You did say sea serpents." Pitt nodded. They intrigue me. I can't tell you why. It may surprise you to learn that I have a mountain of material on sea serpents and lake monsters. Forget the legendary creatures swimming around in Loch Ness and Lake Champlain, said Pitt. I'm only interested in the seagoing variety. Yeager shrugged. Since most of the sightings are on inland waters, that cuts the search by 80%. I'll have a fat file on your desk tomorrow morning. Thank you, Hiram. I'm grateful as always. Giordino peered at his watch. We'd better move along before the Admiral hangs us from the nearest yardarm. Yeager gestured to a nearby door. We can take the stairway. When Pitt and the others entered the conference room, Sandecker and Gunn were studying the region where the latest case of unexplained death was projected on the holographic chart. The Admiral and Gunn stepped forward to greet them. For a few minutes, they all stood in a tight little huddle and deliberated the turn of events. Gunn anxiously probed Pitt and Giordino for details, but they were both extremely tired, and they condensed the wild series of incidents into brief descriptions. Sandecker knew better than to crowd them. Full reports could be written at a later time. He motioned to the empty chairs. Why don't you sit down and we'll get to work? Gunn pointed toward one of the blue globes that seemed to float over one end of the table. The latest kill zone, he said. An Indonesian freighter called Mentawai with a crew of 18. Pitt turned to the Admiral. The vessel that exploded after another ship's crew had boarded her? The same, said Sandecker, nodding. As I told you aboard Ice Hunter, actor Garrett Converse, his crew and his fancy junk were reported sailing in the same area by an oil tanker that went unscathed. The junk and everyone on board appear to have vanished. Nothing on satellite? Inquired Giordino. Too much cloud cover, and the infrared cameras won't pick out a vessel as small as a junk. There is something else to consider, said Gunn. The captain of the American container ship that found Mentawai reported a luxury yacht speeding from the site. He can't swear to it in court, but he's certain the yacht closed with Mentawai before he arrived, after responding to the freighter's distress call. He also thinks the crew of the yacht are somehow responsible for the explosives that wiped out his boarding party.
Sounds like the good captain has an overactive imagination, suggested Yeager. To say this man is seeing demons is incorrect. Captain Jason Kelsey is a very responsible seaman with a solid history of skill and integrity.
Did he get a description of the yacht? Asked Pitt.
By the time Kelsey concentrated his attention on it, the yacht was too distant to identify. His second officer, however, observed it earlier through binoculars before it widened the gap. Fortunately, he's an amateur artist who enjoys sketching ships and boats while in port.
He drew a picture of it.
He admits to taking a few liberties. The yacht was pulling away from him, and his view was mostly of the stern quarter. But he managed to give us a good enough likeness to trace the hull design to her builders.
Sandecker lit one of his cigars and nodded toward Giordino.
Al, why don't you act as lead investigator on this one?
Giordino slowly pulled out a cigar, the exact mate of Sandecker's, and slowly rolled it between his thumb and fingers while warming one end with a wooden match. I'll get on the trail after a shower and a change of clothes. Giordino's slinky method of pilfering the Admiral's private stock of cigars was a mystery that bewildered Sandecker. The cat-and-mouse game had gone on for years, with Sandecker unable to ferret out the secret and too proud to demand an answer from Giordino. What was particularly maddening to the Admiral was that his inventory invariably failed to turn up a count of missing cigars. Pitt was doodling on a notepad and spoke to Yeager without looking up.
Suppose you tell me, Hiram. Did my idea of killer sound waves have any merit?
A great deal, as it turns out, replied Yeager. The acoustics experts are still working out a detailed theory, but it looks as if we're looking at a killer that travels through water and consists of several elements.
There are multiple aspects to be examined. The first is a source for generating intense energy. The second, propagation, or how the energy travels from the source through the seas. Third, the target or structure that receives the acoustic energy.
and fourth, the physiological effect on human and animal tissue.
Can you make a case for high-intensity sound waves that kill? Pitt asked.
Yeager shrugged.
We're on shaky ground, but this is the best lead we have at the moment. The only joker in the deck is that sound waves intense enough to kill could not come from an ordinary sound source. And even an intense source could not kill at any great distance unless the sound was somehow focused.
Hard to believe that after traveling great distances through water, a combination of high-intensity sound and excessive resonance energy can surface and kill every living thing within 30 or more kilometers.
Any idea where these sound rays originate? Asked Sandecker.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we do.
Can one sound source actually cause such a staggering loss of life? Asked Gunn.
No, and that's the catch, replied Yeager.
To produce wholesale murder above and under the sea of the magnitude we've experienced, we have to be looking at several different sources on opposite sides of the ocean.
He paused and shuffled through a stack of papers until he found the one he was looking for. Then he picked up a remote control and pressed a series of codes. Four green lights glowed on opposite corners of the holographic chart.
By borrowing the global monitoring system of hydrophones placed by the Navy around the oceans to track the Soviet submarine fleet during the Cold War, we've managed to trace the source of the destructive sound waves to four different points in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeager paused to pass printed copies of the chart to everyone seated at the table.
Number one, by far the strongest, appears to emanate from Gladiator Island, the exposed tip of a deep ocean range of volcanic mountains that surfaces midway between Tasmania and New Zealand's South Island. Number two is almost on a direct line toward the Komondorski Islands, off the Kamchatka Peninsula in the Bering Sea.
That's a fair ways north, observed Sandecker.
Can't imagine what the Russians have to gain, said Gunn.
Then we head east across the sea to Kung Hit Island, off British Columbia, Canada, for number three, Yeager continued. The final source, as traced by a data pattern from the hydrophones, is on the Isla de Pascua, or Easter Island, as it is better known.
Making the shape of a trapezium, commented Gunn.
Giordino straightened.
A what?
Trapezium.
A quadrilateral with no two sides that are parallel.
Pitt rose from the table and moved until he was almost standing inside the three-dimensional chart of the ocean.
A bit unusual for the acoustic sources to all stem from islands.
He turned and stared at Yeager.
Are you sure of your data? There is no mistake. Your electronic gear processed the tracking information from the hydrophone system correctly?
Yeager looked as though Pitt had stabbed him in the chest.
Our statistical analysis takes into account the acoustic network receptions and the alternative ray paths due to ocean variations.
I stand humbled. Pitt bowed, making a gesture of apology. Then he asked, Are the islands inhabited?
Yeager handed Pitt a small folder. We've gleaned the usual encyclopedia of data on the islands. Geology, fauna, inhabitants. Gladiator Island is privately owned. The other three are leased from foreign governments for mineral exploration. These have to be considered forbidden zones.
How can sound be propagated such great distances underwater? Inquired Giordino.
High-frequency sound is rapidly absorbed by salts in seawater. But low-frequency acoustic waves ignore the molecular structure of the salts, and their signals have been detected at ranges reaching thousands of kilometers. The next part of the scenario gets hazy. Somehow, in a manner we've yet to understand, the high-intensity, low-frequency rays radiating from the various sources surface and focus in what is known as a convergence zone. It's a phenomenon the scientists call caustics.
Like in caustic soda? Asked Giordino.
No, like an envelope formed when the sound rays meet and converge.
Sandecker held up a pair of reading spectacles to the light, checking for smudges.
And if we were all sitting on the deck of a ship that was in the middle of a convergence zone?
if struck by only one sound source," explained Jaeger. "We'd hear a soft hum and maybe suffer from nothing more than a mild headache. But if four waves converged in the same region at the same time, multiplying the intensity, the structure of the ship would ring or vibrate, and the sonic energy would cause enough internal organ damage to kill all of us within a matter of minutes." "Judging from the scattered sites of the disasters," said Giordino grimly, "this thing can run amok and strike anywhere in the sea." "Or along shorelines," Pitt added. "We're working on predicting where the ray channels converge," Jaeger said, "but it's difficult to come up with a set formula. For the moment, the best we can do is chart tides, currents, sea depths, and water temperatures. They all can significantly alter the path of the sound rays." "Since we have a vague notion of what we are dealing with," said Sandecker, "we can lay out a plan to pull the plug." "The question is," Pitt commented, "except for the mineral exploration companies, what do the islands have in common?" Giordino stared at his cigar. "Clandestine nuclear or conventional weapons testing?" "None of the above," Jaeger replied.
"Then what?" demanded Sandecker.
"Diamonds."
Sandecker stared at Jaeger queerly.
"Diamonds, you say?"
"Yes, sir."
Jaeger checked his file.
"The operations on all four islands are either owned or run by Dorset Consolidated Mining Limited of Sydney, Australia, second only to De Beers as the world's largest diamond producer." Pitt felt as if someone had walked up and suddenly punched him in the stomach.
"Arthur Dorset," he said quietly, "the chairman of Dorset Consolidated Mining, happens to be the father of the two women Al and I rescued in the Antarctic."
"Of course," said Gunn, suddenly seeing the light. "Deirdre Dorset."
Then a quizzical look came into his eyes.
"But the other lady, Maeve Fletcher?"
"Deirdre's sister, who took an ancestral grandmother's name," explained Pitt. Only Giordino saw the humor.
"They went to an awful lot of trouble to meet us."
Sandecker shot him a withering look and turned to Pitt.
"This strikes me as more than a mere coincidence."
Giordino came right back.
"I can't help wondering what one of the world's richest diamond merchants will have to say when he learns his diggings came within a hair of killing off his darling daughters."
"We may have a blessing in disguise," said Gunn.
"If Dorset's mining operations are somehow responsible for an acoustic death plague, Dirk and Al have the credentials to walk up to his front door and ask questions. The man has every reason to act the role of a grateful father."
"From what I know of Arthur Dorset," said Sandecker, "he's so reclusive, he won the Hermit Trophy from Howard Hughes. As with De Beers diamond mining operations, Dorset's properties are heavily guarded against thievery and smuggling. He is never seen in public, and he has never granted an interview to the news media. We're talking about a very private man. I doubt seriously that saving his daughters' lives will make a dent in this guy. He's as hard-nosed as they come."
Jaeger motioned toward the blue globes on the holographic chart.
"People are dying out there. Surely he'll listen to reason, should his operations be somehow responsible."
"Arthur Dorset is a foreign national with an immense power base," Sandecker spoke slowly. "We have to consider him innocent of any wrongdoing until we have proof. For all we know at the moment, the scourge is a product of nature. As for us, we are committed to working through official channels. That's my territory. I'll start the ball rolling with the State Department and the Australian ambassador. They can set up a dialogue with Arthur Dorset and request his cooperation in an investigation."
"Now that could take weeks," argued Jaeger.
"Why not save time," said Giordino, "cut through the red tape and see if his mining technology is somehow behind the mass murders?"
"You could knock on the door of his nearest diamond mine and ask to see the excavating operation," Pitt suggested with the barest hint of sarcasm.
"If Dorset is as paranoid as you make him out to be," Giordino said to Sandecker, "he's not the type of guy to play games with."
"Al is right," agreed Jaeger. "To stop the killing and stop it soon, we can't wait for diplomatic niceties. We'll have to go clandestine." Not a simple exercise, snooping around diamond mines, said Pitt. They're notoriously well guarded against poachers and any intruders out for a quick buck scavenging for stones. Security around diamond-producing mines is notoriously heavy. Penetrating high-tech electronic systems will require highly trained professionals. A special forces team, Jaeger put on the table. Sandecker shook his head. Not without presidential authority. What about the president? Asked Giordino. Too soon to go to him, answered the admiral. Not until we can produce hard evidence of a genuine threat to national security. Pitt spoke slowly as he contemplated the chart. The Kung Hit Island mine seems the most convenient of the four. Since it's in British Columbia and practically on our doorstep, I see no reason why we can't do a little exploring on our own. Sandecker eyed Pitt shrewdly. I hope you're not laboring under the impression our neighbors to the north might be willing to turn a blind eye to an intrusion. Why not? Considering that Neuma found a very profitable oil site off Baffin Island for them several years ago, I figure they won't mind if we take a canoe trip around Kung Hit and photograph the scenery. Is that what you think? Pitt looked at the admiral like a kid expecting a free ticket to the circus. I may have overstated my case slightly, but yes, that's the way I see it. Sandecker puffed meditatively on his cigar. All right, he finally sighed. Do your trespassing. But just remember, if you get caught by Dorset security people, don't bother to call home, because nobody will answer the phone.